So, Dave, I got to tell you, I the lady at Smart Cuts hates my guts.
Smart Cuts is like your local haircut place?
Yeah, yeah, like you'd find at a mall, like a Master Cuts and Smart Cuts and stuff like that. You go in, you never see the same people with scissors in their hands twice in a row.
There's... God, isn't that the truth? Okay, yes, go ahead.
There's a huge turnover. There's always that one lady giving you her private card, you know. I'm not going to be here for much longer. Here's my card. You know, but every time I go in, and to the one that's near, and I usually take my boys with me. We all get our hair cut at the same time so I can get it over with, you know. And we always go in, and we're walk-ins, right? And right. The lady always says, do you have an appointment? I'm like, no, because I figured it's in the neighborhood. So either we're going to get our hair cut today or we're going to go next door to the Chinese place and get soup dumplings. It's gonna be a day out one way or the other. I don't care. We come back another day if there's a whole bunch of people there, right?
This gives me a clear idea how important your look is to you.
Oh my God.
I'll either get my hair cut this month or else I'll go get some dumplings.
I try to space it out as much as possible. You know, I'm like, I let it hang into my eyes and then I have it buzz cut. You know? So I don't have to sit in that freaking chair as
how
often
lucky
as possible.
How lucky is your wife? Dream.
She counts her lucky stars every night, let me tell you. So the lady always goes, well, let me see if you're in the system. Give me what's your number? And I said, oh, I'm not in your system. She says, you've never been here before? I go, oh yeah, I come here all the time. She says, well, let me pull you up in the system. What's your number? I said, that's just it. I'm not giving you my phone number. And she says, oh, we don't use it to call. I says, I know you don't use it to call, but Smart Cuts Corporate either uses it to call or they sell it to somebody who's going to call me. And I don't want to get called. I don't want spam phone messages. And I'm not going to give you my phone number. Well, we don't use it that way. I said, I know you don't. We're going in circles now. I'm not going to give you my phone number. And I'm not going to be in your system because I refuse to give out my phone number. And that's the only way that you can put me in your system.
Amazing.
She goes, well, she says, I'm really not going to call you. And I'm like, okay, you've worn me down. Here's my phone number. 555-555. She says, you can't use that. It's not a phone number. I said, if you're never going to call the fucking number, you don't care whether it's a phone number or not. I just exposed you for the fraud that you are. Now leave me alone. Give me a haircut. By the way, do you know how dangerous it is? You know how dangerous it is to start out this way with somebody that's got your hair in their hands in the next 5 minutes? I come out lopsided, big patches left in my hair. Yeah, but I refuse to give these people my phone number because, listen, by the way, everybody who's listening to this knows I'm right. The reason they try so hard to get my phone number is either that they're going to call me with spam or they're going to sell my number to somebody else who's going to call me with spam. There's no other reason for them to want my number this badly.
Well, I gotta tell you, I know that you are right. I know that you're 100% in the right, but you sound so much like the gummy mint is trying to put fluoride in my water. Oh, the UN's black helicopters are coming. They're going to get me.
Oh, I hate it so much. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And it's like, she says, well, that's the only thing. She says, that's how we put you in our system. I says, then you need a new system. And that's not my problem to solve. You need a new system. If you need my phone number, get a new system.
Up until the 90s, and frankly, even now, there were a lot of companies and school systems that were like, just give me your social. I'm just going to put your social in here. I don't want to give you my social.
Exactly.
Slow down. I'm buying new oil for my car. I'm not giving you my social. Anyway, on that note, hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about identity theft and making comics.
And bad haircuts and making a living from comics. I'm Brad Gunn, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, who do we got over there?
Well, you may have heard the melodious chuckle coming from a third voice, and that voice belongs to our dear and beloved co-patriot, Lex Fajardo, coming from Santa Rosa. Are you technically in Santa Rosa right now, or where should I?
No, we are chiming in from Santa Rosa.
Yes. You are chiming in from Santa Rosa.
Yes.
So you know Lex from KidBeowulf.com and also from the Kid Beowulf books. And he is also, this is fun to say, an Eisner Award-winning senior editor at the Peanut Studio. The Eisner was just this past year, right? This was months ago.
It's crazy to say and weirder to hear, but yeah, that was just this past Comic-Con.
Now, I would be walking around the house so annoyingly going, Daddy's got to go poop. I'm going to carry this Eisner with me. Daddy's going to go make him a sandwich for himself with his Eisner.
Yeah, no, there was a fun first weekend of having brunch with the Eisner and photo shoots with my dog with the Eisner and just, you know, carrying it around the house, petting it lovingly. It was quite a thrill and quite a crazy thing to wrap your brain around. Cause it was for a book. Celebrating Snoopy was the book of this archival. It won Best Archival Project. And, it was this big, huge coffee table size book. I don't know if you guys have like the great Andrews McMeel book of the best of Calvin and Hobbes or the complete tome.
Yes.
Similar in that kind of trade dress. And it was just Snoopy through the decades and, you know, people still love Peanuts and Snoopy and that's a big part of my livelihood, thank goodness. So, yeah.
Well, listen, we're thrilled to have an Eisner winner on the show with us, but I do know that you are a humble man, Lex. You'd be the first to say when you put your pants on, you put them on one leg at a time, just like anybody else. Except once those pants are on, they're the pants of an Eisner winner.
Right, sure, yes. Well, because I've gotten
the
big
4-minute setup for that joke. Yeah. That was the longest walk to that punchline. Yeah.
Well, you know, when they give you, you can get the Eisner little seal. And so, you know, at the end of the thing, they just give you a whole sheet of them. And I've just been putting them on the back of my pants. So as I walk down, people can say, there's a butt cheek Eisner winner right there. So
that's amazing. So Brad, he's walking into a Starbucks and they're like, okay, sir, that'll be $3. And the wallet flips open and there's the Eisner seal inside. You're like, oh, did I leave that there? I'm sorry. Eisner winner. I'll just take my coffee now.
That's so embarrassing when that happens. It keeps flipping out there. I have no control over it.
He's got to go in for his physical and they're like, okay, Lex, we're going to step out. If you could just put the robe on and take all your other clothes off. They come back in. 40% of his body is just covered in Eisner seals. They're like, sir, sir, there's some parts we need access to. No, that seal's staying right there.
Nurse goes out of the office, goes up to the waiting desk, says, it's that Eisner guy again. The fourth time this month.
I was going to say, he keeps coming in. Boy, you didn't know when you agreed to do this podcast that there'd be a 2-minute run on you and your Eisner seals, did you?
No, that was not in the preamble, but I will.
Thank God you didn't win a Harvey.
Right. Yeah, Brad's runner on Harveys, and what you do with those is a whole different thing. You don't want that one. Right. So congratulations on winning an Eisner because you're getting Brad's cleaner material, which is good. Right. This is always a fun question, though. Where do you keep it, in all honesty?
Well, it's that's a great question because, you know, it was, you know, my other life as you know, a cartoonist, it's sort of the stuff I do, you know, at home. And then there's the stuff I do at the Schultz Studio. And so, you know, it's one of those things I'm still trying to wrestle with. Like, yes, I won it for my editing life. And it was a book that we put together at the studio. And so, you know, I thought, well, this belongs at the studio because it was a group project and everybody really pitched in and we made this beautiful book. And so I was ready to put it on the studio shelf with, there was another, actually there is a Harvey Award, I think, for one of these other, you know, editions of Peanuts and some other things.
Brad's immediately dusting off his Harvey jokes. Okay, here you go.
And so I was talking to my friend and boss and fellow cartoonist Paige Braddock about it. And she's like, no, you should just keep it in your office. It was a studio win. We'll keep it there on a bookshelf next to the book. And she just sort of like reaffirmed that, no, it's okay. You know, this, you won this award. Yeah, it was a studio project, but it was, you know, you brought it all together and be proud of it and put it on your mantle in your office. And so that's what I've done. That's where it is. That's where I, every lunch hour, I sort of take it down and I spin it. And, you know,
spin on that little axis?
Yeah, it really does.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Holy cats, that's wonderful.
And it's got a nice, you know, heft and weight to it. And I eat my ham sandwich at lunch and spin the Eisner and then we put it back on the mantle and go back to work. So
what I love about the spinning Eisner is if you ever needed to do a kind of backyard film project where you needed to shoot the Daily Planet, if you shot in a close enough with a macro lens, you could make that look like the top of the Daily Planet if you filmed in a an upward fashion. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that line of questioning. But so this actually does raise a topic that Brad and I want to talk to you about, because for a lot of the cartoonists that we talk to, their day job is accounting, or their day job is they work for an airline, or their day job is they work for a computer company. And that's helping with the bills. That's helping with the health insurance. Mm-hmm. That's helping all this sort of stuff. You are the rarest of things where you step away from your cartooning to do cartooning, which is the coolest possible thing in that your day job is surrounded with the Peanuts work. And your night and weekends and personal time is surrounded by Kid Beowulf. So talk us through that. How does that work for you? How awesome or not awesome is it? How does that work for you?
It's the most awesome thing in the world. I mean, the only thing I'd rather be doing is just, pardon me, my stuff full time. You know, Kid Beowulf all the time. Just being able to spend long hours at the drawing board. You know, in light of that, I'm able to spend and get paid for working with comics and working with a property that, you know, when I was a young cartoonist trying to do a daily strip and get it syndicated, Schultz was who we looked to. He was the epitome of success, of artistic integrity. Like, that's the thing that I would read every morning with my Cheerios and sort of, you know, study and think about and ponder. And so to be associated with to the Schultz studio, to the Schultz family, to the legacy in any regard, in the little blip that I am, is a huge honor that still on a daily, basis kind of shocks one, or at least myself, to sort of feel that I'm making decisions about Snoopy and Charlie Brown and you know, turns of phrase and licensing and that along with all the rest of the studio, has impact on a licensing global scale, which actually, now that I said that, is really frightening. So it's a real thrill, and it's also, you know, it helps keep my own creative fires burning, because, you know, we are, myself and, you know, a dozen other cartoonists and sculptors and accountants and people who are always kind of running the Peanuts empire, you know, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So one point of view might be superseded by another, or some sort of marketing thing that's going to be put through, or all these different promotions and tentpoles and whatnot. So what's really actually the saving grace for my sanity is being able to step back and like go to my drawing board and my little universe of books and say, okay, I'm in charge here. And the things that I want to do and the story points I want to talk about and things I want to draw, I don't have to report to a committee about this. And there are a number of us actually at the studio who have side projects, and that's the sort of thing that I think keeps us sane. Because sometimes you'll get a wackadoo question from a licensee in Japan who wants to do a certain thing with, you know, Snoopy and Farron or the bunnies or this and that, and you sort of like you get into this, this huge discussion about content and, you know, what would Schultz do and what would Sparky want, and then. And you can spin out of control. And then, so it's really nice to come to my studio, close the door, and just focus on my own work.
So when you joined the company, did you meet Charles Schultz?
No, sadly, I came on board in 2007. So, and he passed away in 2000. By that point, truthfully, when he passed away, they didn't really think, you know, that the Peanuts licensing would continue, because he was the creator of content and everything that he created was sort of put into the licensing. So there was a few years where I think, you know, at the time it was United Future Syndicate who was still running the strip, and United Media was sort of their licensing arm. Paige Braddock was there. Schultz had handpicked her and brought her in. She's a cartoonist of Jane's World and a number of other properties. And he brought her in to sort of be his creative director so he could just sort of focus on the strip while she kind of did the licensing. So Paige, along with Jeannie Schultz and the family, kind of, you know, after his, you know, death, kind of to really kind of figure out, okay, how do we move forward? How do we keep Peanuts moving? Because at that point it was a monolith. They made a dozen different decisions. But I think the biggest one was to open up the archive and to give licensees access to Schultz's work from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. Because up until that point, Schultz really, you know, we're all hypercritical of our work as cartoonists, and he really didn't like anything that he had done 5 years, beyond 5 years in the past of his work to be on product.
Right.
So there was really kind of a very classic, you know, Schultz line look to everything that was in licensing. So opening up the archive to everything really just opened up the licensing and I think Peanuts in a huge way that nobody really could fathom, that was, I think, the key.
Yeah, there's a couple early years there that a couple of licensors have picked up on, and I really appreciate that really early Peanuts that very firmly sits in that mid-century feel, you know?
Yes.
You can almost see somebody driving a big Buick in the background kind of a thing, you know?
Right. Or a Ford Falcon.
Yes, or Ford Falcon, that's right. When I see licensees picking up on that, I'm always like, oh, that's a fun period for Peanuts to tap into. And I'm glad that you guys opened that up. But when you started in 2007, because I don't know if Brad's been there. Brad, have you been to the Schultz studio?
I have not been there, you know.
Oh, open invitation then next time you're in California.
Brad, you should take him up on that. It's a fun place to see. So there's now, I guess, Lex, what's the best way to describe it? There's now four major buildings. There's the museum, there's the ice rink, there's his original studio. And now, when did your studio get built, the newer building?
Yeah, so that was there. The museum was built in 2000.
Right.
It was sort of broke ground in 2000 and it opened up a few years later. And so they built sort of off, not too far away from the studio, the original studio. There was this other building that sort of was storage for the museum. And we then sort of took it over and converted it as a adjunct studio. So there's a studio that Schultz built, which looks very much like a dentist's office from the 70s. It's very unassuming and then across there's a big ball field that he built for the neighborhood, and then there's the museum, and then across from the museum is Snoopy's Home Ice that Schultz and his first wife built for the community, and that's where the Warm Puppy Cafe sits, where Schultz would have his breakfast and lunch every day. And so we call it Snoopy Central. It's kind of this nice little campus that has these different pockets of sort of the ice arena is its own kind of entity, and the museum is its own entity, and then the studio. We all work in concert with each other, and it's a great place to be. And Schultz is very much the patron saint, so to speak, of Santa Rosa.
Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of sprinkled all over in certain statues and statuettes and murals all over town. Yeah, but my favorite thing, Brad, I got to share before we go on too much. But I got to share this one part for the museum. I every once in a while, if I'm feeling chuffed about myself, I'd be like, I've done 4,000 Sheldon strips. No, 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 no. Oh boy, haven't I had quite the career? No, 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 no. And then you walk into the Charles Schultz Museum, and there is a wall that represents the 17,000 or 18,000. Strips that Schultz has done, and you kind of retreat back into your turtle shell and you go, I have a lot to accomplish. I haven't even started.
It is a massive wall, and it's done in sort of a mosaic of Charlie Brown. It's all built of strips, but the mosaic is of Charlie Brown running to kick the football, and Lucy's holding it, and that actually represents just one decade of the strip.
Right. So that's right.
Yeah.
So I was standing with Fred Schroeder. This is when we were filming for Stripped, and I was like, wow, look at that. It's all of Schultz's comic strips. And they're like, oh no, no, sir, that's just one decade. And I vomited off to the side a little bit.
Yeah, it's astounding.
It is astounding how, and so when you have all that to work from on a day-to-day basis, does that inform your own comic strips? Does it stunt your own cartooning? Does it change your effect? Does it inspire your cartooning? How does that work for you?
Personally, it's, you know, because if you were to look at my own work, it comes a little bit more from the European tradition of like Tintin, Asterix, even Jeff right. Smith Bone, because I'm doing sort of long form graphic novel storytelling. But artistically, you know, Schultz was in that camp too, very much a classic traditionalist, you know, doing everything on the page and everything by himself. So the auteur component of that is a huge inspiration. And I actually have in my office, I have one of the original strips, but it's empty. It's just the template, and I have it kind of framed, and it's next to my desk. And I just to have that.
Wow.
It reminds me, I can look at it and like, that's the thing I admire most about him is like, he was a craftsman. Every day he went to work and he had that template to fill in and to ponder and to think about. So that kind of like is ground zero to sort of just look at that and think like he was just like us. He was just trying to figure it out every day. And that's what I love about the strip. If you read it from the 50s all the way through, and especially in the 50s, he's definitely figuring out how a comic strip works and mm-hmm. how it works for him and who these characters are and I just love the whole process of it all and to see that take shape in a way I don't think, you know, outside of comic strips we really see anymore. And maybe that's because, you know, readers don't have the patience. They want the thing to be, you know, from day one to be polished and clean. And I think comic strips are that rare daily, reading activity where you can see just this artist figuring it out and getting better with each one. So yeah, I really love that blank strip. And then next to that, I have all 26 volumes of the complete Peanuts that Fantagraphics put out. And so just, you know, sitting and taking in the breadth of his work and that he did it for 50 years without really a break is just, it's a nice little kick in the pants. I'm like, okay, if I'm having a hard day, well, I need to draw something. So it's helpful.
Because think of all the times that those 50 years of drawing was during flu or a divorce or death in the family or someone broke their leg or, you know, like you could imagine all the life events that he had that we've had. And he kept going for 50 years. It was ridiculous. It's amazing. It is amazing.
And then to bookend that with, you know, the fact that his nickname was Sparky, you know, named after a spark plug from the Barney Google comic strip. And then he dies the morning of his last Sunday strip is printed. Like if you wrote that in a novel, nobody would buy it. Yet that is that's sort of the beginning and end of this man's life, who was completely devoted to his comic strip and loved the art form. It's amazing.
You know what's funny? When it's been, I don't know, what, 18 years since he died, and whenever someone brings up the fact that he died when the last strip ran, my heart always gets a little flutter in it, because I really do think he I mean, Jeannie kind of will hint around it if you ask her. If he kind of died of heartbreak, like knowing that that last one was going up, I think he was like, all right, it's time to go, you know?
And
there's something so beautiful and sweet about him knowing his life story that's probably what happened. And it is, like you said, it's so poetic. And if it's so on the nose that no one would greenlight that if that was in a story. You're
right.
Exactly right.
Right. Rewrite.
They'd be like, Lex, you're too on the nose with that one. Let's let's have him die a week later.
Yeah. You mentioned Jeannie, and one anecdote I would, you know, cause Jeannie Schultz has been just amazing in continuing his legacy through the museum and, you know, the NCS and just a friend to cartoonists far and wide. My very favorite thing about working at the Schultz studio is every now and then Jeannie will bring in an original, cause she has sort of a cache at her home, and then they eventually get brought in and treated and gone into the archive of the museum. But before they go to the museum, she would just bring them to the studio, and she'd just bring him in from her car, sort of just, you know, hanging it from the, you know, holding it from the corner of the big Bristol board. And we could just sit there and look at it like, as if it was just right off the drawing board, and to see his line up close and to examine it. And then it gets carted off to the museum where they put on the white gloves and put it behind this, you know, archival frame and all that stuff.
In the meantime, you've still got like, you know, Papa John's drippings on your hands. As
exactly.
Your eyes are holding, right? You're like, no, Jeannie, don't pass this to me. All right, well, here we go. Right. But the funny thing that I always think is cute is the fold in the middle of a Peanuts original, that they were so big that he folded them. And as a kind of a sweet joke between friends, my friend Fred bought me a Mark Trail original the other day. And it's from the, let's just say it was from the crappier years of Mark Trail. It was an intentional joke. And he goes, look, it's folded in the middle, just like a peanut. And I was like, yeah, just like a peanut. Thanks for the $10 eBay purchase. All right. Well, Lex, if you're up for it, what we normally do on the show is we bring in some reader questions, listener questions. I always say reader, listener questions. Are you up for a quick question if we throw some out at you?
Sure. Yeah. Love to.
All right.
And if I could just interject before you get to that, because you mentioned Fred, and I don't think I've ever formally thanked you guys for doing Strip. That is, I was just watching it actually before Comic-Con. It's one of those that's sort of in heavy rotation, and it's such a beautiful love letter to comic strips and the art form we love. You guys did an outstanding job. So just from myself and every other cartoonist who's ever seen it, thank you for doing that. It's just terrific.
Oh, wow. Hey, Brad, now you see why I invited him on the show.
Now
we can end the show. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for having to listen in on this week.
Good night, everybody.
We'll see you next week. No, that's really nice of you to say.
That crossed my mind listening to last week's show, because we do mention Stripped at the top and the bottom of the show. If somebody's been, for whatever reason, remiss in never having seen that, where can they see that? Is that still on Netflix? Is it? What's the best bet on viewing that?
Netflix ran Strip for 2 years, and then they dropped us like a rock. They dropped us like a rock. They're going increasingly to their own original content, so they're licensing less and less documentaries, and specifically less independent documentaries. So we enjoyed our two-year run on Netflix, and now you can get it on iTunes, you can get it on Google Play, you can get it on VHX, which is a different platform. And the nice thing about VHX is I think we made available 35 original hours of the interviews. And so every once in a while, I'll pop one of those old ones on. It's fun to listen to Jeff Smith or Mort Walker or this or that. You can get it Stripped on iTunes, Google Play, VHX. I don't remember where else. I mean, I guess we should put it up on YouTube with ads at some point now. It's been 4 years, so... it's funny though how there is a life to a film. There's a life to a project, as you both know. And when a film starts to fade, it's like it really starts to fade. It kind of drops out of consciousness pretty quickly. And so it's been interesting to see how that one definitely has an exponential curve downward in terms of overall downloads.
You think?
But it is 4 years old.
Okay. I see what you're saying. In terms of viewing, I was just thinking in terms of content, it's still very current, because you guys, you know, you start at the beginning of Strips and then the move into digital, and you know, that was one thing that struck me, is that it's like, you know, the information you're presenting is still very much it's very salient today.
Yeah, well, that I'm so thankful to that project, A, because it was truly a love letter. I had so much fun for 4 years doing it, and then also, getting Watterson to do the poster for it and having him mail the original to me to scan, because he didn't want to scan it. He didn't know how to do his own scanning. And so the fact that he mailed it in just an envelope with no protection at all. I'm like, wow. This could pay for my kid's college. Why are you mailing it to me like this? But just to hold it in my hand and to see the scale that he worked at, which is very small and delicate and beautiful. Like, I'm so thankful for that experience. That film is a really special place in my heart. So anyway, the short version is thank you. I didn't expect you to say that, and that's very nice of you.
No, yeah, it's true. How big was the poster, by the way? It was like 8.5 by 11 or smaller?
The original one?
Yeah.
I have a super high res scan. It's about 7 by 8, 7 by 9.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay.
Was the original drawing. I should actually thank, because there's a specific way I said to him, I said, hey, Bill, on the back of one of your books, I probably have it here on the shelf with me, on the back of one of your books, you had your watercolors really cleanly contrasted against a pure white. How did you do that? Because I was like, I want to do that on the poster. And he goes, I have no idea. I sent that to the publisher and they did that. And I was like, all right, thanks. Pro tips from Bill Watterson, everybody.
Right.
Have your publisher do it.
Get a good publisher, yeah.
Yeah. So I should thank Lars D'Souza, because I made a kind of a quiet public call to other cartoonists saying like, hey, how could I replicate this look? And another cartoonist, without even knowing what I need it for, and it's specifically Lars D'Souza, said, here are the 15 steps you need to do with watercolors to make it look like that. And he saved my bacon and made that poster look great. So I will never stop thanking him in public for that.
Wow. That's terrific.
So anyway, Strip is now out in the world, and the nice thing is the people that have found it, like you say, every once in a while they'll pop it back on, and I'll get a really nice email saying how they're continuing to enjoy it while they draw, and that's really nice. As artists, we can all appreciate how special that is. But anyway, you know what? I actually remembered before we get into the questions we had from listeners. So Lex, you had a thought, and you wanted to bring it up to Brad and I think this is a fun one. You were talking about, is Patreon right for me and my work? Do you want to elucidate real quick what kind of angle you were fishing at there?
Yeah, it's something I struggle with because, you know, early on I've done Kickstarters for my own work, and by the way, congrats on your bonkers drivekickstarter.com success. That's terrific, because I don't know if people realize how hard crowdfunding is. I mean, unless you've actually done it, it is a real bear. So I've had my experience with Kickstarter, and then when Patreon came on the scene, which was what, like maybe 2013, 14, or was it earlier than that?
It was around the end of 2013. It came on, but it was like just a blip, and it really didn't crest until 2014.
Okay, and I think that's maybe when I kind of dabbled in the idea of maybe trying it for my own work, and for a hot minute, I did do a Patreon, and it was sort of to help fund. My work was originally published in black and white, and I was transitioning to color. And I thought, well, I could use the Patreon as sort of the ongoing funding to pay the colorist and sort of and produce the work and then put it out online. And it was just really hard to get traction. I found like discoverability on Patreon was really tough. Like unless you know somebody is actually on Patreon, it's impossible to seek out new artists. And I think that's still kind of a frustration for me whenever I go there. I'm like, well, who's, you know, I have to be directed specifically to their page. But I found that it was just hard to get my readership, which, you know, truthfully, I'm doing an all ages graphic novel. So it's mostly kids and some obviously adults sprinkled in that. But to get them to sort of turn them into patrons, I found that to be really a struggle. And maybe I just didn't set up my page properly, you know? So, you know, ultimately I'd like, well, I'll just put this on the back burner. Maybe Patreon is not conducive for the kind of work that I'm doing. And I still go back and forth. I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should try it again and see if I can do that turnover, because my work is unlike yours. It is online. People can read it through Go Comics. But I hesitate to say it's not truthfully a web comic. I haven't really structured it as a web comic in that regard. And that's another thing. Like I wonder, like, well, maybe I should try that and revamp the whole site. And so these are all things like internally I'm always kind of debating, and to have the, you know, pros like you to bounce those ideas off of is why I wanted to bring that up.
Well, Brad, do you want to jump on that first, or do you want me
to? So there's a lot of moving parts to that, but let's start here. In terms of discoverability, and Patreon just had a crowdcast this past Friday where they discussed that they want to try to do discoverability better. And out of all the things that I would love to see Patreon work on, discoverability isn't one of them, because I really sincerely think that Patreon is not a place to build an audience. Patreon is the place to take the audience that you've already built. All right. So in terms of that, what I want to know from you is, right now, the main place that you can read this comic is on Go Comics, correct?
Truthfully, they're it's sort of as the graphic novels and bookstores and such. But yes, it is available online to read 3 days a week on Go Comics.
Yeah. In terms of online readership, which is where you are going to build your audience. In other words, you're not going to it's quite so much audience building through a book, although you're obviously going to do some. But in terms of outreach, where it's key that you have someplace that somebody can click, that's where you're going to build audience, and that's where you're going to be able to point people towards a Patreon. Are you able to? I should ask you, because I have zero experience on Go Comics. What
well,
you probably
want zero experience on Go Comics. There is a
well, that's my question. That's my question. I look at Go Comics and I look at Go Comics and I immediately say that's not for me. That doesn't mean that I think it's bad for other people, but it's like, nah, not for me. What did you think the audience building potential was on Go Comics?
Well, I chose to post on Go Comics really because it was kind of the online arm of my publisher, Andrews McMeel. So I thought, okay, well, at least there's some synchronicity there. And it's, you know, it's a fine platform. And I think that they're, you know, I really like the crew that's putting it together. What the audience engagement, and maybe Dave, you can speak to this because I know Drive was there for a time. It's a really, for lack of a better word, it's a unique audience. They always comment about the weirdest stuff that's never really related to your comic.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So it can be a little frustrating. And then sort of trying to get those people to do anything that's not trolling your comic and actionable to supporting it has been kind of a frustration. So yeah, I don't know if truthfully Go Comics is the best spot. You know, for a time I did try Topastic, which I really liked their interface, but also struggled with getting those people from the Topastic site to the Patreon.
And what was your outreach on social media?
Oh, I don't know how social media works. I am on Twitter and I am on Instagram at LexKidBee is my handle both places. Instagram I only started like the last probably this year or so, maybe it was last year. And I just have a smattering, truthfully, of followers in both places. So I would love to learn how to use social media properly so I can build that audience, but it's a bit of a mystery. And so yeah, I look at these places and I know that is where I struggle with is figuring out how to grow the audience online. Because it's sizable in the real world. And I feel like, you know, but you know, getting them, but they have the book. So, you know, they've done their bit for King
right.
of Country.
You've already monetized that section of your audience.
Yeah.
So when I hear that, what I hear is I would really love to see what would happen if you put more effort into social media and maybe had a hub site that was that may have been a little bit different than Go Comics. If what I'm hearing is that Go Comics isn't great in terms of community building, I'd love to see what would happen if you had a more traditional website that you could use for your hub. And had more of an effort towards social media, whether that because for me that's one half of the formula is the audience building half, and then the other half is at some point the big driver on Patreon tends to be exclusive content,
and then
the question becomes what can you make exclusive?
Right. So both Evil Link and Drive. I mean, you guys. The newest stuff is on your website, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think both Brad and I both do it earlier on Patreon. And then Brad does a much better job of having a lot more exclusives that he shares with his Patreon audience. So but I would agree with Brad that having a more because what I like you have found with Go Comics, it's fine. It's in the background of what I do. But
right.
The audience engagement is normally this. I could do a comic about Einstein or a Drive comic about heroism and family. And the comment I'll get is, my cat Tibbles loves to wag his tail. And you're like, what's happening? What is this comment right now? Where are
do you?
You?
Think,
and,
are you certain? Do you think they're bots? I mean,
don't think they're
disconnected?
Bots. Brad, have you ever heard the phrase 72 years old? I think that's what's happening. I think
that phrase, yes, I've heard that phrase.
I don't know. I'm trying to structure that in a weird way. I think a lot of the comments are just like to Lex's earlier point. It's just a lot of non sequiturs of like, okay, thanks for reading. And you're like, I don't know how to build on this.
It's to comment. And it's never a positive, hey, we really like what you're doing. It's always like, oh, you drew that sword wrong. Or why is that, you know, person, you know, using this phrase in a 6th century inspired, you know, setting. So it's like, come on, guys, it's a comic. Give me a break. I just gave it to you for free. So yeah, it has its own unique frustrations for sure.
Yeah, you're right that there's, because there's 400 titles on Go Comics, I don't know that they feel as much, and so maybe this is what we're talking about for a minute. I don't know that readers feel as an individual a connection. Lex, do you think that's a fair way to say it?
That's a great point. I hadn't even thought about that.
Like, I don't, and maybe that's why they're not as supportive, because they're like, well, if you're not making me laugh today, pearls before swine, well, if not pearls before swine, then Mr. Pibbles' house, the new comic, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great, great point. Yeah, because it just sort of populates in their feed. They can just scroll right through. It's not like they're actually going to, as Brad said, that hub site to get that content. It's sort of just being given to them. And whether it appears on that day it's supposed to update or not is probably, you know, not even something they're aware of. It's just sort of, it's either there or it's not.
Well, right. And that's the other part of this too, is that I still hold that I like to have a hub site. In my business plan, I like to have a hub site, but you have to also have to realize that a dwindling number of internet users are consuming media that way, right? My website is a slow dwindle down in terms of page views per month, if I look at it. But I'm doing better in business than I ever have. And that's because people are not reading things on websites. They're reading them on social media. And if you're avoiding social media, you're avoiding where all the readers are. That's where they're going.
I'm not avoiding social media. It's avoiding me, but I see your point.
But listen, I'm letting it, it's because you're such a nice guy, I let that go once. And you're bringing it back again, and now I'm going to hit you. What's so freaking confusing about posting a comic on Twitter? I mean, you can say you don't get it and everything, but this isn't rocket science we're talking about here, right?
No, that's fair. And I think, you know, when I think of both Twitter and Instagram, I mean, I really like actually how Dave is posting on Instagram, and I've played with that because I just think the swipe format is just it's better for comics.
Yeah, Twitter for your pages too. That would look fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've played with that and have gotten good engagement. Twitter, I don't know if I'm using it incorrectly, but I sort of just use it as, you know, things that might be happening in my schedule or you know, conversations or likes or whatnot. I try to keep, I'd like to keep the content unique, like the art specifically to Instagram, and then the more like conversational stuff to Twitter. And maybe that's incorrect, I don't know. But I of the two, I certainly prefer Instagram, and that is where I post lots of process stuff, the making of the graphic novel. You know, and then pictures of my dog, which gets the most engagement for sure.
I think that's where you're going to build your readership is on social media. And that means posting the comic so that I can read the entire comic, either panel by panel on Instagram, or, you know, frankly, you can do panel by panel on Twitter as well. And in terms of building community on Twitter and Facebook and these other places, it's really not about like I can see Instagram's audience. You might want to cultivate a look, right? I get that. Although, Dave, what's your thoughts? Posting dog pictures and your comic on the same Instagram feed. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll be honest. If I had a dog, I'd probably have photos of my dog on that on that feed. But I get where you're coming at from this, Grandpa, which is that you want it to be pure. Is that what you're about to say?
Yeah.
That you want it to be
a little bit. When I just know, listen, of the three of us, I have the least success on Instagram. It constantly befuddles me. And I'm making my fourth real big re-attempt at it this month. But yeah, when I look at Instagram and I follow this person because I like his comic, and then I see a picture of a hamburger that he's going to eat, I'm kind of nonplussed. It's like, this is not what I came here
nonplussed?
For.
Nonplussed? Did you say
nonplussed?
Yeah.
Nonplussed.
Nonplussed.
Yeah. Is that right? Nonplussed? Is it nonplussed?
I'm leaning toward nonplussed. Yeah.
Nonplussed.
I thought it was a French word. I was using the French pronunciation of plus.
Lex, I think you can agree that in this conversation, we're all feeling non-plus.
Yes, very much so.
I've had a very non-plus day. Non-plus. Non-plus sounds like some dance move in an 18th century waltz that no one does anymore. And put your leg back with a kick as the beat comes in and you'll do the non-plus. And we're turning, we're turning, we're dancing, we're turning. Non-plus, non-plus.
It's real. I've been pronouncing it that way for how many people have heard me say that and were too polite to so, correct me.
Lex, what you need to know about Michigan is it's famous for its French education in underage schools and so on. No, so
really
like
big on Montessori. Yes.
To get back on track, though, I do, for whatever reason, I do the same on Instagram, Brad. I keep it super pure, super duper pure, because my experiment has been what would happen if I just do the comic on Instagram. None of my personal bullshit, none of my food, none of my travels, none of my politics, none of that. What if it's just the comics?
Yeah.
And I've been doing Twitter for, I don't know how many years, 8 years, 10 years, whatever it is. And I've been doing Instagram for one. My Instagram is now twice as big a following as my Twitter feed. And I post to Twitter like 7-8 times a day. So maybe
what are the magic hashtags that you're using?
Non-plus is the big one.
That's the one we're going to be using this week.
That's the one you're going to want to use. That's your golden ticket right there. No, so maybe there is an argument for keeping it pure. I would admit to that. But I do want to address this one thing, though, Brad, because I can say from having read Lex's work in Our House and the kids love it, that it's not a question of whether kids react to it or whether they love it, because they do. But here is my bigger question. How do you specifically market or get out into the world a kid-focused, or at the very least, a kid-friendly comic into an internet world that is largely geared towards adults interacting with the internet? You know what I mean?
Well, that's a great question. And as a matter of fact, a number of years back, I was kind of doing some research along these lines about possibly doing an all-ages comic. And so I asked myself that same question, how would I do that? And I don't know that I've got the right answer, but I will share what I came up with to you.
Okay.
And that was that I wouldn't be marketing to kids. I would be marketing to teachers and parents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And librarians. Yeah.
In other words, so I started researching all these different reading levels. There's a ton of different ways that you can determine the reading level of a printed piece. And there's a bunch of scales. And so my outreach would be towards mainly teachers who are who've got kids that are what they call reticent readers, because that's where comics are really showing some power, is to convert a reticent reader into reading more, you know.
And that those teachers and librarians are very active. Actually, that's where I engage the most with that particular audience on Twitter.
The second thing that I would be doing if I were pursuing this specifically is if you want to penetrate into this particular demographic, Scholastic or one of the publishers like that. Have you approached Scholastic with this book?
Oh yeah, yeah. I have a ton of rejection letters from Scholastic.
Why? Your stuff is gorgeous. What's their problem?
Oh, that's nice to say. Back when I was self-publishing, they had just started their graphics imprint, and I think they were launching with Bone. I have gone through the litany of publishers, and I'm very happy with Andrews McMeel at the moment. They're doing we relaunched the trilogy in full color with them. Obviously they're not the New York powerhouse that Scholastic is, but their distribution model is good, and we do get into schools and libraries. And so there is that. But I think it, you know, when I think of my work, I definitely try and put it in at least the same selling category as something as like Bone and Amulet and Asterix and those sorts of books. As you say, like the teachers, librarians, they're the ones that will help get it to the younger readers for sure.
And here's what I'm going to tell you specifically towards that is look at, especially this month, look at the social media feed of Kazu, who was just a guest on this show. Kibayushi, I did it right.
Yep.
Look at Kazu's amulet, all right?
Yeah.
Right now, if you look at his social media outreach, it's all about one thing you see over and over again. Teachers with books and kids with books, and teachers with books and kids with books. Teachers saying, we're so excited about having the book in our library. And he keeps putting that message out over and over and over again. If I were trying to pursue this the way, this sort of thing, the way you are, my social media feed would be filled with that kind of outreach, because that's the messages that are going to get spread around is again, reticent readers and teachers.
Lex, what if you structured, because I'd like to try to crack this nut, because I always try to think, like, what would Jeff Smith do if he was trying to break in with Bone right now? And the honest to God truth is I don't know for sure what he would do. But I honestly think that if you had KidBeowulf.com structured in a super iPad-friendly way for kids to read maybe even the first two complete things free, easy, you know, make it ad-free, all that sort of stuff for just those two. I would have a feeling that you could then build on that by saying, hey, parents, if your kids are enjoying it, kick in a buck for a new page every week kind of a thing on Patreon, and then be able to kickstart a new one every 2 years or so.
That'd be a tremendous.
I think the idea of encouraging parent and child iPad reading next to each other would be a nice way to do it. I don't know, Brad, what other brainstorming ideas could you come up with?
I mean, kids are more and more, they say screen dependent, but basically what you're seeing is more and more kids have screens in front of them. And so this idea of having an iPad-friendly version, and B, I would even go towards like what we're seeing on Webtoons, and I'm finding this. I've just started doing it, and I'm going to check in with you later. But like Webtoons, where you're putting the work panel by panel in a vertical scroll, and you can convert a graphic novel page to a vertical scroll panel by panel in most cases, unless you've got a super horizontal panel. Most cases, you can convert that pretty easily. And I would be putting that out, too, for your readers who have smaller screens to read that panel by panel and put that out on something like Webtoons, where the readers are kind of nudge a little bit towards reading on a smaller screen. Those two things, I think, are really strong.
Yeah, and I've looked at the Webtoons model, and that's in the back of my head, too, and my only worry there is just the amount of work to reconvert to get that vertical scroll. But I totally see that would be a good way to go. Dave, let me ask you, when you say the iPad friendly, are you suggesting like rejigger my hub website so it fits in that space, or sort of an offshoot of the site that would be where they would read?
Well, I'm just I'm thinking of your core audience, and it's, you know, from four being read to probably to 11 or 12 reading to themselves, right? And I just feel like as a cost-free way to do it, structuring it for easy iPad reading would be a nice way to bring parents or, you know, caregiver and child together. And then from there, making a pitch to, hey, if you're enjoying this, you can continue to read it a page a week and support it on patreon.com. And then from that same hub website that Brad's been promoting, you could also have a Kickstarter once every 2 years or so for the new book, or you know, however you'd like to do it.
Even going beyond that, when Dave is talking, making it iPad friendly, I don't think, unless he and I are vastly different, I don't think he's talking about what you're doing on your hub website. That's going to be automatically fairly iPad friendly. What I would say that means is ebooks. making that downloadable ebook. That now that is something that I don't have to wait for the website to load every time I turn the page. I can do a much better reading experience, and having that available not only on your site as a download or other sites like Amazon.com where you can buy the Kindle edition and so forth. That would be where I think you're going to really make that inroad on iPads.
Yeah, yeah. And I've definitely done that with Kindle and Comixology as well. But again, I think that's sort of an older readership. But I guess it's a matter of, you know, educating them about this book that their child will enjoy.
And it's about your outreach on social media. You need to be the one going out there and like Kazu is, hammering away at teachers and kids. You know, that's your outreach.
Yeah. One thing, you know, interesting, because I look at Kazu's work and his trajectory with, you know, just great admiration. And because, you know, he kind of started around the same time that I did with Amulet. And the one thing I've noticed is, and I think this goes for his work and the other really top successful graphic novels that are out there. Comics is such a slow build in terms of just the amount of work it takes, but then getting that work out there and then getting people to start talking about it. And my theory is that, and until it was like Amulet Book 4, it was always popular, but I noticed on social media, it sort of got to book 4 and 5 where it became, you know, the thing that was always sort of talked about. And that just sort of grew and grew. And, you know, now he's at book 8, and it's exactly as you say, Brad, it is consuming that space of social media and the conversation with teachers and librarians and their readers. And part of me, when I go to the bookstore and I always sort of, you know, I'm looking for my book on the shelf and the other books and graphic novels that are out there. Cause that can always be sort of frustrating. It's like, well, you know, how do I get people to sort of see the book on the shelf? And my theory is in part, like, you just keep doing the work until you actually, it can't be ignored on the shelf. It's like, you know, it's taking up a certain amount of real estate. So, you know, a book that is in its fourth or fifth, it's like, oh, well, this clearly has some sort of pedigree. Maybe I'll check it out. Of course, it's a long, long game, but part of me sort of in the book space feels like you almost have to create a shelf that, as I said, cannot be ignored when you walk into the bookstore.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're getting at in Kazu's specific place. There's also something about not only does it have a certain pedigree once there's like, oh, there's 5 of them. Well, it must be good if it's lasted to 5. Mm-hmm. But it's also, as a parent, I know that every time I'm going to a bookstore or going to a library, when there's just part one of what's eventually going to be a 19-part series, it's really frustrating to just get to the end of part one and you're like, well, all right, well, I'll check in 10 years. That was
exactly
fun. So just seeing it now, it's so clear to me why teachers and librarians and parents all would recommend Amulet. It's because there's 8 of them now on the shelf and you're like, okay, if I start Little Johnny on this one now, this will take me through summer or this will take me through to Christmas or whatever it is, you know? And it's really satisfying that there's more to come for them. So yeah, you see why that Rolling Stone has picked up speed for his career as it does, as he puts out more and more books. But to that idea though, like, because it's also a tricky fallacy of like, well, if I just keep doing it, it'll get the audience.
Sure.
And so I think there is still really good kernels to take from Brad on that.
That is the cartoonist delusion of grandeur that I think we can, I can certainly be susceptible to.
Oh, so. Yeah, I many a time in my career have I said, but I've done all this work and I keep doing it. So surely that, where is my solid gold car? I want my solid gold car. But yeah, so I do think though that having 1 or 2 very easily shareable PDF or ebook formats that you can give out for free as the loss leader, basically, on a site that's more geared towards parents and kids with a Patreon supported page. And even if it's just 5 or 10 people at first, who cares? You know, that helps out with this or that in terms of expenses. and then build it up slowly. And the thing is, you can't just put up a Patreon page, and I think Brad said this already, you can't just put up a Patreon page and expect it to take care of itself. You have to constantly be feeding that river with tributary rivers of social media and posts on your site and directing people, that because they're not going to be aware of it. And as we said at the very top of this, the discoverability is not great on Patreon. So you've got to be the one continually, in a friendly way, pointing people back towards, hey, I have a Patreon. Hey, I have a Patreon. Hey, I have a Patreon, you know. Right. So anyway.
Ooh, Dave, I've got one thing I want to jump into real quick here in terms of bringing this conversation to a close. Okay. Here's one more thing that I would do. And Lex, you're like a step ahead of me because I'm going through your site here and I see the Kid Beowulf Reader. 200 pages of full color fun, character dossiers, and I pronounced that one right. But it's history, right? This goes back towards the original Beowulf epic, and I'm assuming this 200 pages is something a teacher might use for a kid that's reading Kid Beowulf to say, here's something that is in the story that's based on history, right?
Yeah. It's a book I put together with an educator, and it's got lesson plans and the origins of the original epic and decisions I made to jump off and bibliography and yeah, it's a
dude, smorgasbord. There's your exclusive Patreon content. Mm. That's what you put up on Patreon.
Oh.
And you've already got 200 pages head start. And if somebody wants to buy that, they can, right? But you've got that now uploaded in chunks as monthly Patreon content for educators, and you build out from that, and you go in and, you know, if Beowulf and Grendel are in medieval Spain, then you've got a lesson plan that goes in and talks about, you know, maybe the economic system of right. medieval Spain. And that's your exclusive content. That's how you get people to become a Patreon backer and do outreach to parents and teachers and homeschool parents by doing that as exclusive content.
Well, that is
That's
super
a
smart.
Great idea.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and you know what, Brad? So Lex, you have 8 titles right now for Kid Beowulf, or
there
7
three,
titles?
There are 3 full graphic novels and like 3 to 4 short stories. Yeah.
Okay. So I just had a thought to couple on to Brad's. So the reader could be uploaded in chunks, as Brad said. But maybe what you do is, as an instant loss leader, you say, sign up for my Patreon now, get an immediate ebook download for free, or, you know, as a as a gift for you, and then pick whichever one you know is the most enticing and or will lose you the least amount of money by giving it away.
Right.
And just set up a Zapier or something that will immediately send them the ebook when they sign up for Patreon. And knowing that there will be a percentage of people that will get the ebook and go away.
Yeah.
Brad, what are your thoughts on that? Is that a bad idea? Is that a good idea?
I think that's great. In fact, that was the other thing I was going to bring up, because I'm sitting here and I'm getting more and more interested in Kid Beowulf, right? And I'm sorry, I wasn't exposed to it earlier. Dave was holding out on me, so I blamed him.
I did not share my copies.
But I'm, right. I'm looking at this and I'm like, hey, I see right at the top, free ebook. Well, okay, I'm in. The art is beautiful. Everything I'm looking at, the writing looks like it's compelling. I'm in. And I click free ebook, and I got to sign up for a mailing list, and I'm out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Lex, I love you like a brother.
Oh, you know what? He's back at the haircut place.
You ain't getting my Lex. You ain't getting my phone number, and I'm not signing up for your freaking mailing list. Just give me the free ebook. Why would you? You don't need any barriers between. You're trying to get that ebook into people's hands. You want to hook them. You want to get them into the reading your books. I don't want. If I want to be on your mailing list, I'll sign up for your mailing list. Don't do that to me.
That's interesting, because that is a strategy that I got from some folks that, you know, because that was during the, like, your mailing list is everything thing. So entice them. So, yeah, no, that's a good point.
I know. And listen, mailing lists are great. Mailing lists are great. Dave, you do great stuff with, like, with mailing lists and outreach that's based on that.
Well, I want to publicly say, Brad, I do increasingly less interesting stuff with mailing lists, just so you know.
Well, okay. Well, I know Lex's that Corey, thought. When we were on Survivor driving creativity. I know at PVP they do a lot of stuff with email based outreach to their and as people are going to sites less and less, pointing them towards being able to get your strip or your comic pages emailed to them is a really smart thing, and you should absolutely be pushing it, but not at the expense of me looking at that and saying, I don't want to be on your mailing list. I just wanted the free ebook.
Right. You know? Right. So, yeah, wait, so yeah. Perhaps if, you know, if I get to the point where I rejigger and take your great idea about using the Patreon and that reader to entice teachers and librarians, perhaps that send my free ebook points them to the free download that lives at Patreon, and they can, and that could be the enticement. And then whether or not they join the Patreon is up to them based on what that freebie that they get.
I think you could experiment with that and see what happens.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Thank you.
So, and listen, Dave, now that we've straightened Lex out, now that we've gone in and fiddled with his life and completely thrown everything upside down, let's change gears here. Let's shift a little bit.
I like that we came into his house. We removed all the furniture. We sold his Eisner Award.
I got that in the glove compartment. We didn't sell that.
Brad just polished off the word Fajardo and typed in Geiger on one of those home label makers over it. he's got his home sander out. He's sanding off Lex. All right. So we got a question that I want to ask both of you, because this is a fun one. And I think emotionally we can all relate to this, especially I'm putting together a book right now. And boy, can I relate to this. Dave and Brad, I'm about to start posting my very first long form webcomic. I wanted to wait until I had finished 25 pages before I started posting. Smart move. But I'm finding that within even those 25 pages, the last 10 pages are much better than the first 10. Should I redraw the beginning of the comic so that the quality is better, or should I just start uploading what I have and keep drawing the next part of the story? What's a good base number of pages to post on a first update anyway? Brad Geiger, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not going to be helpful. Listen, if you redraw your first 10 pages because the last 10 pages don't look so good, then you're going to have the same 25 pages, except now the first 10 pages look better than the last 10 pages. So you're going to redraw those last 10 pages. And now the last 10 pages is going to look better than the first 10 pages. And you're never going to get past 25 pages. At some point, unless those pages are really, really faulty, if they're just unviewable, Or if there's a change in the writing that you see has to be made because it's going to cause serious problems down the road, it's got to be a really big problem either in the art or the writing before you start redrawing pages, because you'll never get anything done. You're gonna have paralysis from analysis and chase your tail for the next 2 years. So no, I would say take a good hard look at that. And be careful walking down that road, because you'll be redrawing your butt off while the rest of us are out there making comics. What do you think, Lex? What would your advice to this person be?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's something you probably want to avoid as an artist, just because it's the nature of art is to you know, get better the more you do it. So we're always going to be hypercritical and not like the page we drew 2 weeks ago, but you just have to keep moving forward. The one caveat is, you know, in terms of my own work, when I self-published the second book in my series, there were maybe, you know, 10 or 15 pages where I had sort of made a leap in my drawing style. So when we relaunched the book in full color, I decided to just redraw those 10 to 15 pages to keep it a little more on model for the second full color edition, just to smooth out, and for my own edification. But by that time, you know, the 270 odd pages for that story were done and in the can. And, so I George Lucas did just a little bit, but in terms of, you know, moving forward and on a web comic, and it's really important to produce the work and to get into the frame of mind of moving forward. And I think your audience is going to understand that too. And, you know, maybe they'll even like to see the strides that you've made from page 1 to page 25.
Well, let's take that back, Lex, to what we were talking about at the top of the show. What would have happened if Charles Schulz would have never gotten into the work in his 60s because he was redrawing the work that he did in the 50s? I mean, you can look at that stuff that he put out, and you can see he changed drastically over the years. If he would have been redrawing comics, he would have never gotten to 18,000 or whatever that final number ended up being, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So I have a thought on this that I want to, because I agree with both of you that you can do analysis from paralysis, and in which case you're going to get totally nonplussed. but I do want to say this, though, that the start of a project is a unique time. And here's what I mean by that. If we were better at what we do, we would spend a couple weeks doing character designs, character studies, character angles, environment studies, panel layout experiments before we really start our comic, you know, our whatever long form story. And I think all three of us can identify with this thought is that you get 50 pages into a comic of a new long form story that you're doing and you're going, oh, now I know how to draw this person.
Sure.
Now I get how their look should be. And that's happened to all three of us. I guarantee it's happened to all three of us.
Yep.
So I think what's happening to this person, because I have done this myself, is that they didn't give themselves the time to develop the look, develop the style, develop the feel of what that story was going to be. And then they got 25 pages into it and they go, oh, now I know how to draw this. You guys think that could be what's happening here?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing, sorry, I was just going to... You know, it's also your process and how you are developing the story. There are some who will, you know, in terms of a graphic novel, will write and draw and thumbnail the whole 200 odd pages, and then they will begin to actually draw the story. I don't particularly work that way, but I know that is certainly one process, which I think, and in that approach, you do work out those kinks. And so that by the time you get to page one, you've got a better sense of the world you're building.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And in an ideal world, my stories would be better if and when I did it that way. I don't, but I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think this person, one of the reasons why I'm hesitant to 100% agree with both of you that this person should not go back and redraw this is that maybe what their gut is telling them is, oh, now I figured out how to draw this right. I wish I could go back and just redo the first 5 or 10 pages. And I don't know that is... as terrible a thought as if they were on page 150 and they go, I want to go back and redraw pages 70 through 80.
Because
I think that's less likely to happen, you know?
Mm. No, I agree with you, Dave. Although I would say, again, take a long, hard look at that and make sure that that's where your head is at. Because, you know, like I said, you could be exactly in that zone where Dave is talking about. Or you could just be being hypercritical,
yeah.
You know, so take a little time with that decision and, you know, it's good that you're thinking about this, but take a little time with that decision and really know where your head is at. However, let's talk about that second part, because I really like that too. What's a good number of base pages? If you were launching a comic right now, Dave, and you've got 25 in the hopper ready to go. How are you gonna approach that publishing schedule?
This is a great way to do it. If I had 25 right now, I think I would launch with 5 to 10 and keep the other ones as my reserve, as my buffer. And the reason I would do 5 to 10 is it's just enough to give everybody a sampler of what joy we're about to jump into, but not so much that I don't waste that buffer that I've built up. I think having a 2-week buffer is great because any one of us could go down for the count with an illness for a week, and then you have a 1 week, and then sooner or later, life trickles in a day, stealing a day here, stealing a day there, and then your buffer's nothing. So having a 2-week buffer is pretty nice, and 5 to 10 right out the front is pretty great. What are your guys' thoughts about this? Lex, what do you think?
It's always good to be well ahead of schedule, especially if you're going to start posting on a regular basis. And so are you suggesting that the first 5 pages would sort of be given as a chunk, or like that first week before you get, if you decide a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule, or just to sort of get them hooked?
Well, Well, yeah, I guess if it's long form, you would start them with 5 pages of the story already ready to go. Or I guess if it's short form, the kicker there, the problem with jumping in with 5 short form already ready to go is that people might not go backwards in your archive and look at the previous 5 that you've already done. I'm not sure. I think long form, you want to start them with enough of a teaser that they can and jump into it. But long form, I don't know, Brad, what do you think? Is short form worth it, having more than one on there?
Well, let me start here, because I disagree with both of you guys, because both of you guys keep talking about schedule. And I don't think a schedule is as important as it was in 2005. Because, as I said, most of our readers are reading, getting their consumption through social media. So I am not as tied up. I'm not losing sleep over the social, schedule like you guys are. My answer to this question, I've got 25 pages. How many should I post to begin? And the answer is another question. Where's the hook? Where's the hook in this first 25 pages worth of material?
Hopefully,
it's soon, because you with shorter and shorter attention spans, and I say this to my students. I'm teaching storytelling at University of the Arts this semester, and I made this point. I said, listen, if you guys think I'm wrong about setting the hook early, try to watch a movie from 1960. Try to watch a movie from 1970. You'll find that we had a lot longer, or they had a lot longer attention span back then. They took a lot longer with their storytelling. It was longer before you set the hook. Today, you better be setting that hook within the first 5 or 10 minutes of a movie, or else people are walking out of the theater. And it's the same with comics. If you want to capture your reader, if you want to really get them, you got to have some kind of an emotional plot hook that gets them soon. And I'm hoping it would be somewhere before 25 pages. So how many do you post on that first day? You post enough to get to the hook. And then the next update day, whatever you decide that is, again, I'm not all that torn up. I'm not all that emotionally invested in a schedule. I'd say you take the rest of those pages and you say, okay, where's a nice place to end? Where's my next plot point? Maybe it's a page, maybe it's 2 pages, but I want to get to something significant in that next swing. And then that's going to guide me going forwards. Every time I update, I don't want it to just be 2 people sitting at a kitchen table, one saying, pass the cream, pass the sugar. That's the end for today. Tune in tomorrow. That's BS storytelling. I want to get to a plot point next. Maybe it's a moment of humor. Maybe it's a cliffhanger. Maybe it's a surprise. Something. Give me something. And so that's how I would parcel these pages out going forward, is set the hook and then give me plot points. Boom, boom, yeah. Boom.
That's what I actually really liked about the format you could do with Topastic, and I think you do it with Webtoons too. You could build it by scenes, and that's a really enticing way to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we all agree, all right, on the Brad's idea of the hook is better than a fixed number. I actually think that that's better than my answer. So I'm going to rescind my answer about 5 to 10, and I'm going to wholeheartedly co-sign with Brad's idea of post to the hook.
Yeah.
So that you know you at least caught them. Because sometimes you only get one chance when you're launching something to get somebody to have a look.
Yeah.
I will triple co-sign on that.
So the one thing I want to say, though, too, that, you know what? I'm going to save that for pro tips. Never mind. Just a reminder, if you're a Patreon
Screw
backer.
You, non-Patreon backers. You ain't getting that little bit of wisdom.
Well, this is a good time to remind everybody that our Patreon backers get a special podcast that's only for them, called Pro Tips. That's all just actionable things that you can do for your comic and your artwork and your business. And so I'm saving this one for Pro Tips, everybody, like a big Scrooge McDuck.
Well, with that being said, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the always avuncular and never nonplussed Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com, and my personal friend.
And my good buddy Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And our wonderful guest today, we want to give a big shout out to him again with kidbeowulf.com. Please go check it out, especially if you have kids. My kids love the books, and so yours will too. Lex Fajardo, thank you so much for joining us today from Santa Rosa, California. And once again, kidbeowulf.com is his website you want to go check out. And Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. Help me out, guys. Patreon.com/comiclab.
Wow.
That was a horrible idea.
That's like three dudes at a wedding trying to dance. That was just terrible.
Oh, well done, guys.
Let's never do that. Let's never speak of that again. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks so much, guys. I appreciate it.
And put your leg back with a kick as the beat comes in, and you'll do the non plus. And we're turning, we're turning, we're dancing, we're turning. Non plus, non plus.